Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, yeah, I got nothing. This is That's My Boy. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Blast Zone.
Welcome to the Blast Zone.
I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like That's My Boy, which we'll be talking about today.
Unfortunately.
But before we get into Ian, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing all right. My week was made worse by this movie, but I'm plowing through it because, you know, universe throws a lot of nasty shit at me, and I'm just rolling with it.
Look at this. When we're done with this episode, recording it, you could be done with this movie. It's not like you have to sit there and edit this episode and listen back to it many times and come up with a new theme song for it. And oh, wait, I'm sorry. That's me. I'm done with this movie once it's recorded. You have to actually spend a lot more time with it.
That sounds like a fun weekend.
But it's not all bad news. We have a great guest with us here to discuss the movie.
That's right.
Please join me in welcoming Twitter personality, Adam Sandler film expert. It's Haley at Toose Addington. Haley, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. I am so ready to get into some Sandler discourse from one of his notable films. Maybe not notable, infamous.
Yeah, this isn't just the worst Adam Sandler movie. I think it might be the worst movie, but we'll try to parse that out as we go.
It's nice to have a prestigious Sandlerista such as yourself to bring the expertise.
If you have not seen Haley's, I don't know, would you call it cosplay as Adam Sandler?
It was a Halloween costume, but it's kind of, I've integrated into my wardrobe. So yeah.
Right. Cosplay. The basketball shorts, the baggy like Superman shirt.
Like Disney bounding for adults. I'm like Sandler bounding in my everyday life.
Exactly. Well, we always like to start off with talking about something we all watched this week, not related to the podcast. And that will be a welcome refuge this week. So Haley, did you watch anything that was interesting recently that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, actually, I've been on a big rom-com kick because earlier in my life, I was so vehemently against them. And I've been trying to get back into them. And there's one I like in particular that I watched again yesterday called How to Be Single. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
It sounds familiar.
It's Dakota Johnson and Rebel Wilson. And they're like two single girls in New York City. And one is a relationship-aholic and one is always single. And it got pretty bad reviews, but it's honestly a great watch. There's some really funny moments in it. I think it's just because it's a rom-com, it was overlooked, but it's a fun watch.
I do remember this movie. Now, I don't think I saw it, but I remember the trailers and everything. And I find Dakota Johnson very interesting to watch, very delightful on screen. So
and you get this a chance. Nicholas Braun, cousin Greg, you get to see his ass in like the first 5 minutes of the movie. So it's like,
oh my God, cousin Greg. Now I have to watch it.
Yeah, there you go.
We're big Succession heads on this podcast. Yeah, so absolutely. Ian, what about you? What you got for us?
Well, I'm following the escapism route because I certainly needed it this week. I rewatched Fury Road. Because I had watched it when it came out and I kind of was just lukewarm about it. There's something about the movie at the time and where I was a little bit exhausted by it. But this time I came prepared for its pace and its energy, and it's just visually awesome. And you know me, I love short movies, and this movie, half the movie plays back on fast forward. So I'm like, hey, the director is right at my speed. He's getting us quick through these scenes. And so that was fun for me. And it's a cool movie. A lot of people think it's like a top tier, great movie of all time. I'm still not sure it's that, but I really like it. And it's fun.
I like Fury Road a lot, but it is at the top of my list of the series I want to do one day about movies that seemed like they were going to bomb, but then didn't, because it was like a famously troubled production. And also George Miller had made like one movie in the 30 years since Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And it was Babe, Pig in the City. So I was like, does he still have it? I don't know. Like all these car races in the desert and shit. It seems like he's gone soft on us, but no, he brought it for that
one. Quite a leap.
It was all practical effects. I think that's why a lot of people really love it.
And yeah, it feels old school in that way and really visceral.
Now the movie I wanted to talk about is kind of a combination of the two movies you guys wanted to talk about. It's kind of a rom-com and it's kind of a car chase movie. I am going back in anticipation of F9, the Fast Saga, and watching all the Fast and the Furious movies.
Cool.
So I watched the first one again, which is kind of a rom-com between Vin Diesel and Paul Walker, and also a car movie with a lot of car chases and stuff. And I know it's been talked about. It's hilarious how low stakes that movie is compared to where they are now in the franchise where they're literally racing submarines and I think they're going to space. Like, they're just stealing VCRs in this one. And it's charmingly low effort and low budget. Like, Paul Walker just has, like, a full beard in one scene because his stuntman was like, I'm not shaving for this fucking movie. And it's beautiful. So clearly, like, just Point Break with cars. But I don't know. I'm excited to track the trajectory of the series and see, like, where it really goes off the rails. I think it's Fast Five, but I'm going to have to come to my own conclusions on that.
I think it's a fast summer for a lot of people. I never got into those movies before, so I'm doing a little dabbling myself. I feel like it's time for me to catch up.
I mean, they're absolutely ridiculous. And stupid, but they're kind of fun and they make sense on their own terms, which is all I want for a movie. Stick to the rules you set up in your weird little extended universe. It's like all it is like continuity porn for people now because the timelines are so convoluted and like characters that died in the third movie were somehow alive during the fifth and sixth movies. It's very strange, but I respect it. Yeah. Haley, are you a Fast and the Furious fan?
I am devastated to say I've never seen a single one.
Wow. Yeah, it's okay.
I'm much more on the car side of the dichotomy when it comes to racing movies. So
gotcha. You're a Lightning McQueen fan more yeah. So? Okay. That's understandable. But they're so far gone from having anything to do with cars at this yeah. point. Like if you started backwards, it would feel like the strangest story ever.
I might have to do that now. Thanks for the idea.
Yeah. That could be a podcast on and of itself. Newcomer to the Fast and the Furious franchise watches them bastards. Yeah. So we can't stall any longer. We got to talk about That's My Boy, the Adam Sandler comedy in quotes yeah. from 2012. And I don't know. Do you guys want me to just tell you a little bit about the movie and where it came from and how it got made?
Just before you do that, usually I jump in and go, yeah, how did this happen? But no, I'm not saying that this time because I just want to preface this whole conversation with establishing a circle of trust between the three of us for the remainder of this episode. This could become a very special episode because there's some topics in this movie that are very painful if you take them seriously, which you probably should. And we're going to have to talk about them. And I don't know, this might take us places. And I just don't want this to be a regular episode. If we treat it too literally in our normal format where we just joke about it and laugh about it and give our little Hollywood criticism, I feel like we become complicit in what the filmmakers did in this movie by milking it for further content. And so I hope I don't bum you guys out. But that's my little preamble that I want to establish that. So let's feel free to take this wherever it goes.
All right. Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
There's definitely a lot of touchy subjects that come up in this movie and they are not handled with care or subtlety at all. So it's important that people are aware this might be an episode that is a triggering for some people just because of the subject matter of the movie. So in 2009, Adam Sandler teamed up with Judd Apatow to make Funny People, a movie we've already covered on this podcast that seemed to at least acknowledge, if not outright condemn, the kinds of lazy, high-concept comedies that had come to define much of Sandler's acting career. 3 years later, he made That's My Boy, proving he took nothing of substance away from the experience of making Funny People.
Except for the substantial money.
Filmed between May 2nd, 2011 and July 15th, 2011 in Massachusetts, the film included such comic and acting heavyweights as Andy Samberg, James Caan, Will Forte, and Susan Sarandon, making you wonder what kind of blackmail material Sandler possesses on these people. The script from David Kasp was rewritten by no less than 5 well-regarded comedy writers before filming and still manages to make light of statutory rape, child abuse, child neglect, fat shaming, and incest.
At least there's no granny porn.
Is there a foul-mouthed, over-sexualized grandma? You bet your fucking ass there is.
God damn it.
Released on June 15th, 2012 to abysmal reviews and disinterest from audiences, the movie made $57.7 million theatrically and was unable to recoup its production budget of $70 million, just like I am unable to recoup the 2 hours of my life I spent watching this dumpster fire of a movie. And that is the story of That's My Boy.
Well said.
Thank you. Yeah, usually there's not a lot of behind the scenes background information going around about this movie. Most Adam Sandler movies are made as an excuse for him to go on vacation, and it felt like he wanted to go to Cape Cod with some of his friends. So he decided to make this movie. But, you know, it makes me long for the days of the low stakes. There's really no plot type Sandler comedies like Grown Ups or Blended, like those kind of really low effort, lazy movies, because yeah, he tries to really do some stuff here. None of it works and all of it fails.
Yeah. And why try those things? What is good of what would have been good about doing those things? He's not going to make the movie that actually addresses the sexual abuse. He's never going to try that. Why go there?
The only theory I can come up with is the fact that this movie came out in 2012, back when the hysteria about the world ending in 2012 was going on. So maybe he was just like, fuck it. Let's put in every blasphemous topic I can think of under the sun and just release. This could be my last movie. I got to do it all.
That's a great theory. Yeah, he was just...
That honestly makes the most sense of any I've tried to come up with. But like, this type of subject matter can be handled well in media and treated with the gravity it deserves. Like, I just recently watched the FX series, A Teacher, with Kate Mara. That was about a high school teacher that has a relationship with a student. And I think it did a good job of presenting the pitfalls and the long-term damage something like that can do. And then to pair it with this movie as a double feature that is just so like irresponsible about everything. Not just a teacher having sex with a student. That's just the first thing that goes wrong in this movie, but it continues in every which way.
Yeah. No redemption whatsoever.
No, the only person who gets redeemed is the Sandler character, which we'll talk about. Like, the moral of the story seems to be like the way he lives his life is the right way.
Exactly.
Which is another issue. But this movie is mind-boggling that it would have been considered regressive in its handling of social issues in like 1983. It'd be one of those movies now where people are like, well, you got to understand, it came out in 1983, like Porky's or something.
Right. But
no, it came out in fucking 2012. Yeah. It's insane to me.
Look, this is not an excuse, but I just want to say here that I didn't know what else Adam Sandler had been doing with his life. You guys have had more exposure to it. Like for me, Adam Sandler was Opera Man and the Turkey Song and the Hanukkah Song. And then he was like, I saw the other big things that he did, Wedding Singer or Waterboy. And then, of course, I saw some of his recent stuff where he got into some more legit movies. And so, like, I knew he did trashy stuff in the middle that I had successfully ignored. And I just thought they were maybe dumb and kind of juvenile. But this was like, I just jumped into the deep end of the pool and it was made of scalding lava and it was a horrible experience.
Now, Haley, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say this is by far like his most offensive movie. Like he has offensive stuff in all his movies, but they all seem to be kind of like well-intentioned and good-spirited. And then this one is just such an outlier.
Yeah, usually he kind of peppers in the problematic themes throughout. He doesn't make them so central to the movie, whereas this is just, okay, give me five of the worst things someone can do, and I'm going to make them core to this movie. It's very
the main character, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you go back and watch The Waterboy, there's definitely problematic stuff in that, but the main character of Bobby Boucher and his core circle of people and the things that they do, like they all are trying to do things for the right reasons. I can't believe I'm trying to break down The Waterboy to like this level, but
you're
rooting for Bobby because he's sweet and innocent and kind-hearted, and there's stuff happening around him that's bad for sure. And it's not just bad in the sense that the characters are doing bad things. It's bad in the sense that the people who wrote it should not have written it, but it's not asking you to follow them on this 2-hour journey. This movie's 2 hours long. So we have to stick with this character for an entire 2 hours.
There's so much plot. I mean, that's another sin. Like, it's hard to even talk about the milder sins of this movie in terms of screenwriting and editing. Like, why did it have to have so much plot and so many scenes and so many sidetracks and not be a 84-minute movie? But yeah, that's in there too.
It doesn't work as a comedy because the jokes aren't funny. It also doesn't work as a movie because it's not structured like a movie should be structured. No. There's just way too much of everything and there's no real distinct acts to it. And Vanilla Ice is in a lot of it. I don't know. I'm very confused. I'm confused and I'm upset. Should we go through the story such as it is?
I'm imagining what listeners who have not seen this movie, we have now set them up with so much loaded expectations.
Right. I wish I would have had these. I saw the trailer back when it was first out in theaters and I had no idea. This was not shown in any preview. You did not have a taste for any of the stuff that was going to happen in this movie. So I went into it thinking it'll probably be just as bad as Grown Ups. But wow, it just, the bar just plummeted.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first 5 minutes, let's give people a taste of what this story is about. So 12-year-old Donnie Berger is sexually abused by his math teacher. She is arrested and sent to jail while pregnant with his baby. Donnie is then forced to raise the child, and he also becomes a national media sensation. Then, 20-some years later, Donnie's fame has faded. He's estranged from his son. He's an alcoholic. He's broke. And he's about to be thrown in jail for $40,000 in unpaid taxes. Then he learns that his son, now going by the name Todd Peterson, played by Andy Samberg, has become successful and is about to be married, so he hatches a plan. A sleazy TV host agrees to pay Donnie if he can reunite Todd and Todd's imprisoned mother on camera. So Donnie crashes the scene at the Cape Cod summer home of Todd's boss, where the entire family is staying in preparation for the wedding. Todd has told everyone that his parents are dead, so Donnie introduces himself as Todd's best friend.
Yep. So lots to talk about in this section of the movie.
Yes.
So Mrs. McGarrigle, the teacher that gets pregnant by Adam Sandler's younger counterpart, seduces him with very little prompting. He makes like a snide comment in the hallway and she gives him detention. And that's just enough for her to go to town on him while his friend is in the room. So,
yeah.
But the movie stops shy of making her an outright, even a Todd or Han Solo, as he was originally named, is fond of his mother. Like nobody really seems to, except, you know, she gets jail time, but only the judge in this scene is like angry about it.
Yeah, that was very interesting. There was one voice of reason throughout the first 20 minutes, and it was just a 2-second character.
Exactly. Right. Like, guys, that does not absolve you, because the second after she says, you are horrible, this is a crime, you're going to jail, the bailiff and the court stenographer high-five each other. And it's celebrated throughout, and it's celebrated so deeply, right? Normal people like us, we turn on this movie and you go, ah, this is a funny, dorky kid, and he's trying to come on to the teacher, and he thinks he's cool, and he kind of looks like Adam Sandler. And then all of a sudden, she turns the tables on him, she's seducing him, and you're like, what? Why? What's happening? Why are they doing this? No, don't do it. And then she does it, and then the movie just loves it. The kid loves it.
There's a montage of like sexual encounters between these two characters. Like she's sitting out back in her, is it a hot tub? And he brings her wine coolers. And then she's leaving him assignments that are graded with notes about how she's going to sit on his face.
A sex note on his face. It's stomach turning. And then it's supposed to be funny, but it's like Haley, you said, the judge is the only one who ever condemns it. And a couple times Donnie goes, oh, I feel uncomfortable. And then he's shouted down by the rest of his classmates and teachers. Like everyone is celebrating this relationship and it's jaw dropping.
I mean, he literally gets a standing ovation when they're discovered having sex at the school assembly.
Yeah, that like, killed me. The fact that they had to have sex on the stage while there's assembly going on. I mean, besides the fact that obviously so fucked up, like why there of all places, and then instant applause when he's discovered. It was very hard to watch. And you feel like, okay, this is just a dream sequence, right? This can't be real. This can't be actually happening in this film. And then you realize, oh my God, this is just the fucking movie.
It's disgusting for all the reasons that it's illegal in the real world, but it's also just, it makes no fucking sense from like a character's point of view. Mm-hmm. Like you have no self-preservation, like no sense of trying to protect yourself from this obvious crime you're committing. It was just a very strange scene to include there. But I guess that was the way everyone becomes aware of it. And the Donnie Child character isn't like embarrassed or upset when he's discovered. He raises his hands in triumph and gets cheered. Like the movie never really knows how to approach how Donnie feels about it all, because he's still smitten with Mrs. McGarrigle when he meets her 30 years later.
Yeah, he continues to argue that was his love of his life and that was something special. Like in those words, there's a few moments where he gives lines like that to defend the relationship. And you're like, oh, is no one gonna...
He's such a troubled character. But then the way they portray his whole sexual abuse was like, it was a good thing. So it's like, how does he become this troubled character if he wasn't abused? Like, why is he so fucked up now? But they don't actually want to touch upon that. So it's really strange.
Because that's like a complex problem that a movie would have to spend time trying to unravel. Yeah. And they were like, no, we're going to cram in another joke about Vanilla Ice fucking this grandma. So priorities, people.
The subtext of him being a total fuck up and a washout and an alcoholic are that he was really fucked up by his childhood. His father was abusing him. His teacher was sexually abusing him, but yet they let him defend the relationship and they continue it through the end. Like the heroic realization for him as a character at the very end of the movie is that, yeah, now I can finally get back together with her.
Right. Yeah. And that's not good.
That is the opposite of a redemption arc. It's hard to watch.
You're literally reverting to childhood at that point for this character. And I'm not even sure if the movie tries to connect the fact that he's so fucked up with the fact that he was raped as a child. It almost seems to be drawing parallels from like child stars more so. Like that's why he's fucked up, because he was famous at a young age. Not why he was famous, but just the fact that he had all this money and fame and notoriety before he was old enough to grapple with it. And that's what's caused him to kind of fall into this hole. I don't even think the movie necessarily blames his relationship with the teacher for his shortcomings, because you see it with how he relates so closely to Vanilla Ice. I'm sorry to keep bringing him up, but he's a really big fucking part of this movie. He takes up like a third of this movie. But the fact that they commiserate so closely and there's nothing like this in Vanilla Ice's backstory indicates more to me like having money and fame at a young age is what ruined him.
And Todd Bridges too. That's the third version of the child stars gone bad.
The soundtrack was good, right? There's some good needle drops in the first 10 minutes.
If you wanted to find don't remember the soundtrack at all.
You were just watching this in horror. You couldn't even literally comprehend.
I could have been on mute and I still would have hated it as much. So
that's very fair. I do have to bring up the sports cameos, the random stunt casting that he does. And he does it in a lot of movies, but it just feels so far out of place in this one. Like having Rex Ryan be, was he an accountant or a lawyer? I couldn't quite work out what his job.
Like a storefront accountant.
Who's in this movie. Like the whole joke is he's a big Patriots fan because Rex Ryan in real life is a famous Patriots hater because he was the coach of the Jets and the Bills, right, who are rivals. But what does that do for somebody who doesn't know all about all that backstory? You know, this just feels like a weird, like Haley.
Just learned that now. I was like, okay, well, I guess he's a fan of the Patriots. I don't know why I should be laughing at that.
So many references to it with his bobbleheads and his posters and shit. Yeah. If you're not in on that joke, which I am in on the joke and I didn't even crack a hint of a smile. And so it doesn't even work if you get all the context. It's just bizarre. That's another reason this movie's 2 fucking hours long. There's no need for this bullshit. And then Dan Patrick, like, there are plenty of actors out there that could play a sleazy reality TV type host. Why get Dan Patrick to do it?
I mean, I assume without having seen all these other Sandler movies, I immediately assumed, oh, this is a Sandler thing. He's got sports world buddies and he wants to put them in his movies. And so
I think he just wants to like get their cell phone numbers in his phone so he can call them for free tickets or some shit. He's like, if I put you in this movie, then we'd be friends. That's what it's got to be. But then he puts fucking Tony Orlando in there later. I don't understand why he does the things he does. People aren't actors either. And it shows.
Actually, even though Tony Orlando was yet another despicable character, he was one of the people I like better than average in this movie.
But he's fucking Andy Samberg's fiance.
Yeah, that's true.
One's good.
There's just so many different levels of bad character that as long as you didn't commit rape, then you're not the worst. So I guess Tony Orlando gets a pass.
Oh, yeah. No, but his racism is off the charts. So I guess.
Oh, God. Yeah, it is. We'll talk about that in the next section. But yeah, wow.
There's so many things going on that you just bring it up. I'm like, oh, great. Now I sound like an asshole. I forgot that whole part about that character. They all have every facet of them is just incredibly problematic that you forget. Get one part and there that is.
Yeah, it just got me. I retract everything positive I just said about Tony Orlando, by the way.
So I guess Todd Peterson, Han Solo Burger, whatever you want to call him, Andy Samberg's character is like the true innocent in the movie, if there is one. But by making him this like weird, stilted straight man, you're also robbing Andy Samberg of everything that like makes him compelling as an actor and performer. So what's the fucking point of having Andy Samberg play this character if you're not going to let him like be zany and weird?
His zaniness is his math multiplication tricks he does in his head, which is like a really boring bit and they keep doing it.
I just don't know why you can't have Jay Baruchel play this character for probably a lot less money. I don't know. It seems like it's a waste of Sandberg's talent. And we just spent an hour and a half praising Sandberg up and down for our pop star episode, but he's gone down a couple notches just for being in this movie.
Yeah, I would love to hear what he has to say about this movie because it's just so out of left field for him to be in something like this. And I mean, a lot of the cast members, Susan Sarandon,
Not as random for her as you might think. There's a little fun fact I have cooked up for later. Ooh. But there's not a lot of interviews about this movie. No one really talks about it much. I tried to find a quote from Sandberg about anything about this. And aside from like red carpet stuff where you're doing the press tour and you have to, he never really talks about this movie, which of course makes sense.
Which is smart. Like you're saying, Haley, he wouldn't expect Sandler to apologize for this. But if you cornered Sandberg, he would probably come clean and break down crying, I would hope.
Right.
And then Sandler's Boston accent. Now, Sandler is from New England, so I have no excuse for this. He's from New Hampshire, I think, and pretty close to Boston. I can't explain what the fuck he's doing in this movie. That is just a terrible Boston accent. He does it for the whole movie. It's like whenever he does a movie with a whole voice, like for the entire time, it never turns out well. Little Nicky, you don't mess with the Zohan. Although people defend that movie. I've never seen it.
Oh, don't defend it. It's not worth defending. Yeah, I think I made a note, like I was taking notes when I was watching this just to kind of stop myself from going insane. But where is it? Oh, moment of silence for Adam Sandler's vocal cords, because yet again, it's another God knows how long he spent acting in this, just tearing up his throat using this shitty accent that's just so gravelly and unnecessary.
Yeah, it's just brutal. And I mean, the child actor makes no effort to sound like Adam Sandler. So it's very awkward.
Oh, now see, how did this kid somewhere between age 12 and age 40, he developed a Boston accent, but he didn't have it as a kid. But I thought the child actor was spookily like a mini Sandler.
Really? Yeah, I wrote my notes too. I was like, wow, like it was kind of an uncanny resemblance that he only has daughters, so it couldn't have been one of his kids acting for him. But it was kind of strange because usually they're not that great at casting child versions of the adult actors.
Right. Well, I'd say I go back and watch to check, but I'd be lying.
Yeah.
I'm never
going to. Don't go back and watch.
Justin Weaver is the actor. This is his only credit. Oh, so he's never acted in anything else ever since.
Oh my God.
Probably just poor guy. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. He said, this industry's not for me if this is the type of stuff that goes on. But all right. So you want to go through the next leg of the movie? Anything else you guys want to touch on from this section?
Let's hear about Act Two.
All right. So in the run up to the wedding, Donnie tries and fails to ingratiate himself with Todd, but succeeds at winning over the rest of the family and friends. Meanwhile, Todd has difficulties with his fiance, Jamie, her aggressive brother, Chad, and a belligerent priest for some reason. Donnie leads the men on a debauched bachelor party night when he starts to break through with Todd with some fatherly affection. The next day, Todd decides on his own to visit his mom in prison, but the TV crew appears, spoiling the moment and trashing Donnie and Todd's budding relationship. Much to talk about in this section.
Yeah, that's like a pretty fast summary for what feels like endless scenes of Donnie hanging out with the family and everyone thinking everything he does is hilarious and Todd wincing every time because he can't understand why. He's the only one who sees what a jerk Donnie is.
Right. Like an interesting angle this movie could have taken is by making everyone hate Donnie immediately because they see what a shit person he is, even without knowing that he's Todd's super neglectful child father.
Right.
He's still obnoxious and sexist and abusive and terrible. But then everyone loves him and every member of the opposite sex finds him super irresistible immediately. And so that's just the movie doubling down on the fact that, no, Donnie is right. This is the way to live your life.
Donnie is good.
I guess that's everyone the only way. Bad. Otherwise, they would have to probably come clean with their whole child arc and acknowledge that it wasn't good, but they couldn't do that.
No, God forbid you say anything negative about statutory rape in this movie. It's a dream come true for young men all over the world is what this movie seems to posit.
Really does portray that, unfortunately.
And as the movie goes on, there's so much in this second act that I had this seething anger from the very start of the movie. But by this middle section of the film, it weighs you down with so much stuff. I started feeling uncomfortable because I was becoming desensitized to the problematic stuff. I was like, oh, I got to deal with the rest of this movie, which is full of other stuff. And I found myself forgetting that I hated it. For the initial reasons.
Right. You start hating it for movie reasons after a certain point. And then you become numb to everything else. And maybe that's part of what the movie was trying to do. I don't know. But
it's
there's
the
so
Sandler
much.
Effect.
Right.
You cram in as much garbage. So you can't even comprehend it when it's being thrown at you by the second act. Then you got to kind of take it. You're just numb and you're digesting that content, whether you like it or not.
I'd say they're throwing jokes at you, but they're not even jokes. They're just loud moments. They don't even have the cadence of a joke. People just scream what's up at each other nonstop in this section of the movie. And that wasn't funny in fucking 1996 or wherever when it debuted. Why are we doing this? Like, why is this a thing? And that's one of the things that wins Donnie over. That's what makes him ingratiated into this family is the what's up joke. And I'm not going to say it in the way that they say it.
No, it's not.
Thank you.
Maybe you can edit it in later, but no, I'm not doing it. And Todd is ridiculed because he can't say what's up good enough.
Oh, yeah.
And so let's talk about some of the actors that they somehow recruited to be in this fucking movie. Milo Ventimiglia from Heroes and This Is Us. Maybe not my favorite actor, but a serious actor who people seem to enjoy. He is playing a Marine, in quotes, who is just weirdly sexually violent. I don't know how to describe his character. Someone help me out here.
As you said, he just gives off heavy Marine vibes. That kind of sums him up. It's kind of funny that he's in this movie because he was in a relationship with Hayden Panettiere? Yeah, when she was 18 and he was in his 30s. So it's, kind of funny. Interesting. Did Woody Allen direct this movie or something? But his character, he's the foil of Todd. He's everything Todd should be if he fit into the mold of the family that he's trying to marry into.
That's very generous description.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's just that's what Todd should be. He should be this guy full of rage with very little logic. He's got a smooth brain, a smooth, angry brain.
Real smooth brain vibes. Yes, absolutely. And
they make him do the weirdest stuff, though. Well, they make a lot of people do weird stuff, but Milo they really make him just do stupid shit. And it's just barely motivated by anything in the character. What you find out later is that the character is actually kind of off his rocker. And so everything he does that seems wacky is just what it seemed like.
There's no hidden agenda there. He's just a really unusual and crazed person. And
yeah. You can't project any complexity onto these characters because they aren't. That's what you'd usually do when you're watching any kind of normal movie, but you can't do that. This is outside the realm of any sort of analysis that we'd normally do.
You got Will Forte playing another strange character. The very buttoned up weirdo trying to become a partner. And he's not even friends with Todd, really. So he was shocked when he was chosen to be the best man. What did you have to say about him, Ian?
Another one of our heroes who we have lionized to a great extent on this podcast. And his role is less offensive, I guess. It's just the dumb body version of a role that he might otherwise play in a decent comedy. But yeah, it drags him down. All my heroes are in the dirt.
Yeah, he's just the worst version of a wife guy in this.
Right.
And then he turns out he's not even that good of a wife guy because he cheats on his wife. But he's just almost the antithesis of Milo's character.
And Donnie's to some extent.
Yeah, definitely. He's so milquetoast and there's nothing sticks to him. He's just there. I forget how to describe him because it's you could have just cast a mannequin in the same role and it would have had the same effect.
And what a waste of Will Forte then. This crazy dynamic comedic actor who is given nothing of any consequence to do and it doesn't utilize his talents at all. It was they called in favors before they realized they didn't need these people. Why is James Caan playing this priest? That I guess he's a recurring character in some Sandler movies. He's been in other Sandler movies, but I couldn't swear to that. Okay. Just like Dante from Grandma's Boy pops up in this movie. I guess James Caan is this Father McArdle. Is that his name? Father McNally. But he beats the shit out of Todd for essentially no reason. What is his motivation in that scene? And that's a hypothetical question. It's a rhetorical question. I don't expect an answer. But
they actually try to do something story-wise in that scene. It's Todd decides that his problem, or is it Jamie that tells him he needs to stand up for himself? Someone tells Todd he needs to stand up for himself. So he decides to do it in front of the priest, and it was the wrong guy because the priest is super touchy and angry about something.
And a former boxer, and he beats the shit out of Todd.
And it's no fun. I get that's supposed to be the slapstick comedy scene, but it's really joyless. There was nothing good about that. Even in the, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this. That was over by the time you knew it was happening, which was 10 seconds in, you knew it was going to happen.
No, we needed more chances for Donnie to hit people in the head with a bottle because that's a hilarious character quirk he has. He's got a bottle on him and he hits people in the head with it, assault. Literally, how many people does he hit with a fucking bottle in this movie? Seven?
That sound is stuck in my head. I think there was one category in which they got an Academy nomination that was original sound design for the bottle on the head sound.
Original bonk.
Ian, don't fuck with me because I'll look it up. I know you're joking. So, all right. So I guess the time has come to talk about the house staff at Tony Orlando's house.
Oh, my God.
This elderly Asian couple that is basically, he says that they're should be just happy they're allowed in the country. So you can do whatever you want to them and abuse them is what he tells the guests. So that's nice. This is a character in the movie.
And the joke is then that, they secretly hate him and flip him
they licked his plates. Yeah, that's not equal footing. Punishment doesn't fit the crime by a long shot. So we just end up feeling bad because these people are obviously being put upon every day and getting no real, I don't want to say payback, but something along those lines.
Yeah, they don't see any justice. They kind of just align themselves with Donnie's character as a way to have some sort of redemption, but it's still, they kind of still get the short end,
It's way out of proportion to what they've had to deal with. Mm-mm. And it's just another way the movie tries to paint Donnie in a positive light by having him be kind to these people. But that's a lesser of two evils scenario and it doesn't really solve anything.
Exactly.
Not in the way the movie thinks it does, certainly.
And it just makes you feel shitty because you have to watch that. You have to watch them get abused and try to fight back in their little ways.
And wouldn't it be more compelling from a movie making standpoint to have the Tony Orlando character, Steve, who's Todd's boss, seem like a nice guy up until the point where you discover he's been sleeping with Todd's fiance, and then it's more of a reveal and kind of a betrayal. But no, we hate him immediately because of this. Right. So that reveal does nothing. We already hate him. Now we're just hating him again for a different reason. So it's just bad movie making in that sense.
Yeah, see that thought process you just went through to kind of add complexity to the character? You can't have that in this movie. It's you just state what the character is, what they do, that's it. There's no, they don't get to have their fun little arc within the movie. It's just you exist for this sole purpose. You're flat. That's it.
And then we already kind of touched on Vanilla Ice and how he's just a huge part of this movie. He's integral to bringing Todd and Donnie together again. He goes on their bachelor party adventure with them.
Yeah, and it's like a quest. The last third is a buddy quest movie, but it's Donnie and Vanilla.
We kind of have to talk about this rampage they go on where they go to the roller skating rink or the ice skating rink and are just shoving people for no reason. And then they steal from a convenience store and the owner first shoots at them, but then joins them, but then is literally firing a shotgun into a crowded diner for no reason. That's supposed to be hilarious.
That was scary.
Deranged. Like, what the fuck is this movie doing? Why? He aims at a small child, like a young girl, is in the window and he aims a shotgun at her head and pulls the trigger.
They could have at least, in directing that scene, made it more like a harmless blowing off steam. Point the gun somewhere else. Don't put a little girl on the other side of the window. Do anything to not make that a moment of horrific violence, of fear. Is that the laughter that you're after? Is like people who witness a near-death car crash and then laugh because it didn't kill anyone? Is that the joy we're supposed to be getting out of this movie?
I don't think we're supposed to be getting any joy out of this
movie. I'm the crazy one. I'm expecting joy. What am I thinking?
You expect your entertainment to entertain you, and this is what happens. So, yeah, Vanilla Ice, I guess he does fine in this movie. He's not much of an actor, but no one is really in this film.
Someone pointed out that Vanilla Ice is actually maybe the only redeemable character in this because the joke is on him. Like, everyone else is awful and they're shitting on other people. And Vanilla Ice actually plays into the idea that like his stupid world that he created is what he's stuck in and he's a loser now. And so he's actually likable in that sense. He's the only sort of humble character.
Actually, that does make some sense. He had the only line in the movie I think I might have chuckled at, which is when he's talking about Ice Ice Baby. And he says Queen took 50% and Suge took the other 60%. So he owes money every time it gets played. Because yeah. I don't know if you heard the story about Suge Knight dangling him over a balcony so he would sign over the rights to Ice Ice Baby. It gives it's a nice little context to that story. But that's literally the only time I think I cracked a smile watching this movie. So kudos to Vanilla Ice, I guess. It's the best I could say.
Yeah, to me, it's like Adam Sandler had the storyboard up and there was just a big blank. And I don't know what in his fucked up brain thought. He just wrote Vanilla Ice. And everyone's like, what do you mean? Like, how is that going to solve this problem? He's just like, Vanilla Ice. Vanilla Ice. That's it. And somehow Vanilla Ice is the reason that the two main characters bond again. It's because there's no reason in this that you have to have something so illogical that actually acts as that force. And I guess it's Vanilla Ice.
He is a very illogical force. I'll give him that. If you were going to pick a random person to have bring together a father and son who've been estranged, I'd say Vanilla Ice is at the top of the list. So kudos to this movie for one thing, I guess.
Yeah.
And then we just have to bring up that somehow Susan Sarandon's in this movie playing the now 28 years older Mary McGarrickle. And she basically plays her as Jessica Rabbit, I guess. She saunters down the prison hallway to meet her son.
Right.
It's like, why are you being so sexual? Well, I guess her sexual identity is pretty flawed in general, just with the way she relates to children and sex, obviously. But just a weird way to act in front of and to her son. But again, I guess that's in character. So there's one thing the movie's consistent with.
Yeah, she has not been chastened at all by 28 years in prison. She doesn't regret anything she did. She's still the sultry seductress.
And the movie seems to indicate that they're all going to be a big happy family when she gets out of jail. So that's the opposite of growth. Yeah. That is stagnation and arrested development to a T.
Yeah, they never actually really delve into the mother-son relationship. I mean, like, yes, she was in prison, but it's up to your imagination to kind of figure out what's happening between them. And even when they're all together, she's only like kind of happy to see her son. She's still just so into Donnie's character for no reason whatsoever. And I was honestly surprised that they used a hot character for the older Mrs. McGarrickle, because it seems like such a Sandler move to just then have some hideous old woman that they can make fun of. So that actually surprised me. But I mean, I guess if you can have that kind of cameo in your movie, go for it.
They probably wanted some contrast with the grandma because he has such a hot and steamy fling.
Oh, the grandma.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a huge.
That's a Sandler trope to the max, though, like having a filthy, over-sexualized grandmother who curses or whatever in a movie. That's a very Happy Madison thing. They do it in a lot of movies. So I wasn't surprised to see it, but I was disappointed to see it. And I don't think it's been funny since The Wedding Singer. Even if you go back and watch The Wedding Singer now, I I feel like any laughs you may have gotten from it the first time around are lessened now by how many times he's gone back to the well.
It's a full Monty scene in this. Like, it's a dragged out subplot. And maybe you could get a laugh out of it if you teased it and then you came back to it for a little bump somewhere. But like, they just draw it out and there's a whole scene and she's undressing in the bedroom. And this,
yeah.
How do you get through that? I think I disassociated for that part of the film. So
yeah, as you should. It makes me just kind of wonder, like, what are the focus groups like for Sandler films? Because all these tropes you're bringing up, they are so reoccurring. So it's, do they just call the same six people? And one guy's just like, hot grandma has to have sex. Someone else is like, someone screaming. Someone else is like, a gun has to be shot. We need that. Like, who, other than like Sandler and the core writers, who is having influence that is letting these childlike tropes come to light time and time again?
I think a Sandler focus group might look something like Alan Covert, Peter Dante.
Yeah.
Nick Swarsden, yeah. Rob Schneider.
Yeah, like, I was going to say.
It's just all those guys in a room like, this is fucking great, fucked. Bro. So I don't think he's getting a lot of honest feedback from Keith.
But I noticed there was no scene where anyone had to eat poop. Could we maybe work that yeah. in?
Somebody ate jizz.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Todd's fiance, Jamie, because Todd comes home drunk after his bachelor party and fucks and pukes on her wedding dress, which is hanging on a mannequin at the time. These aren't fun words for me to say. I hope they're fun to hear. But so to discover what this mystery liquid is, Jamie decides to lick the jizz-covered dress, and she says, with certainty, this is jizz. So, no poop, but, you know, there is cum eating.
Really hard to see Leighton Meester just fall that far. Like, how do you go from Blair Waldorf, like, the head bitch in charge, and then you're in a Sandler film licking jizz.
Licking jizz off a wedding dress.
I feel for her.
She's had a little bit of a comeback, though. We'll get into when we're done talking about the plot of the movie, kind of where her career has gone since this. She's doing okay, I think, which is good.
Thank God. I would be traumatized if I were her.
Do you think that Sandler is maybe actually a sick, evil genius? And like, the point of these movies is not the movie, but it's him controlling his friends and humiliating them and getting them to do things that they know they shouldn't do for money and for some sense of friendship.
Yeah.
And
like, is he like a masochist? Is that what you're saying? Like, maybe. Yeah, I guess it
very
could be.
Very much possible. Because his wife is also in this movie. She's in pretty much all of his movies. She's one of the massage workers and he asks for a happy ending and just it's super disrespectful to her and she doesn't even blink an eye. And I wonder if that's just like their relationship in real life.
She just thinks he's hilarious. Well, they've been married for a long time, right? So she must find his sense of humor somewhat endearing.
I honestly think she's in the writer's room as well. She's definitely a part of that focus group.
Or at least there's some Stockholm syndrome going on.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Ian, can you take us home, please?
So in the final act, Donnie learns some terrible secrets that Jamie has been sleeping with Todd's boss to ensure that Todd gets a promotion, and also that she regularly has sex with her own brother. After first accepting Jamie's hush money so he can pay off his tax debt, Donnie decides he must do right by his son. So he crashes the wedding, reveals that he's actually Todd's father, and he outs Jamie as a bad person. Hearing this, Todd calls off the wedding, quits his job, and begins a new happy life as Donnie's son.
As if the movie didn't have enough going on, now there's incest.
I just knew it. I had a feeling the second Milo came on, I was like, they're going to have some fucked up brother-sister thing. And did they maybe inspire Game of Thrones? Who's to say?
Well, I think the books were well written by this point. I don't know, maybe they were inspired by Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But there was definitely like hints throughout the movie. Like he always hugs her a little too long.
Right.
He seems weirdly interested in their sex life, Todd and Jamie's sex life. It's telegraphed a little bit, but still you hope the movie won't have to go there, but it does.
Unfortunately for us, Jamie and Chad do not push Donnie out a window. Maybe the movie could have been over right there. The
Things I Do for Love.
Yeah, an Uncut Gems ending.
Yeah, an Uncut Gems ending would have been more welcome in this movie.
I think all Sandler films should have an Uncut Gems ending. I think that would be the
That's
only
a great idea.
Redemption arc he could have.
I'm with it.
I like that ending more now that I've seen this movie. I was horrified at the time, but now I'm like, oh yeah, that movie had a killer happy ending.
You're just going to watch that movie on repeat now?
Yeah, I'm now going to watch it and just smile and enjoy
it. It's therapy at this point.
So the movie, like we said, seems to close with the belief that Donnie's way of life is superior. Todd quits his job as a hedge fund manager. And I'm not saying being a hedge fund manager is what people should aspire to be, but there's got to be a happy middle ground between that and like hanging out at the strip club with Donnie all day, right? Like,
I don't know. Sierra's like, there, so that's kind of cool.
Poor Sierra, she deserves better.
Thank you for bringing that up. When she first showed up, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? I know there's a lot of cameos, but I've never expected Sierra to be in a Sandler film. And then she ends up being the love interest for Todd's character at the end.
Right.
That just fascinating to me.
And her character seemed fine. She seemed, you know, not objectionable in any major way.
There wasn't much to her, which is the best you could do in a Sandler movie.
Yeah, being a thinly drawn character is actually a positive in a Sandler movie.
You hope for that. You pray that I got the bit part.
So an hour and 56 minutes, this movie can go fuck itself. I can't believe they really stretched this runtime this long. Like, even for Sandler comedies, that's long.
That is quite long. Yeah.
I think this was the unrated version, but it's only a 2-minute difference between the unrated and the R-rated version. This movie did get an NC-17 rating a couple times before they appealed it and got an R rating. Not too surprising. There is a lot of nudity and the subject matter probably should have been NC-17, but Sandler. There's got friends in Hollywood, I guess. And then we didn't even talk about the marathon payoff, which is stupid. I guess just as a way to explain how Sandler gets out of his predicament, Donnie doesn't take the money from Todd. But in the beginning of the movie, he placed a $20 bet on a obese man to win the Boston Marathon because it had 8,000-to-1 odds. And lo and behold, he wins. Yeah, he gets his money. Fuck off.
And it didn't need to. It's just some more fat shaming jokes to wedge in at the end of the movie. It's like sprinkles on top of Donnie's Vindication Sunday that the movie has built for him. How everything he's done has led to the best things in life for him because he's accepted that he's going to jail. He's going to do his 3 years. And then he's like, oh, I'll be getting out when Susan Sarandon's getting out. They're like, everyone is okay with this. And then they're like, wait, we've got fat jokes and an even bigger surprise fun time ending for Donnie.
Yeah, it just reinforces that he can do no wrong and everything will work out for him because it does. And yeah, so that's my boy. Anything about the final section of the movie you guys wanted to bring up?
My lunch.
Seeing the credits, I've never felt such freedom just because it was like there have been some long Sandler movies. Grown Ups 2 is 1 hour and 45 minutes. And then this just takes the cake. Exactly. I know. So just knowing it was done, I felt free and I'm never going to watch it again. So
I'll never watch it again. Yeah, I don't know how drunk I would have to be. But yeah. I stayed through the credits because I thought they were going to do a stinger or something, but they didn't.
Oh my God, the terror of a stinger on this movie. Coming
what else could they do?
So let's talk about the production of the movie a little bit and kind of who was involved in making it. It was written by David Kasp, who I alluded to, is kind of a big TV writer or more of a creator, I guess. He made Happy Endings. Are either you guys familiar with the show Happy Endings?
I've heard good things.
Yeah, really good show that was on ABC in like the early 2010s. And then he made Champagne Ale, which like 7 people saw, and I'm one of them. But it was good. It was on YouTube TV or whatever premium service was. But then he made Black Monday, which is on Showtime and is pretty good. This was his only film credit, the only screenplay he's ever written. But then it's kind of hard to say how much of the script was his because these are the people that rewrote the script before it got made. Adam Sandler himself, Tim Herlihy, famous SNL writer for many years, Robert Smigel, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, and also famous SNL writer for many years, David Wayne from Wet Hot American Summer fame and all those movies with the Stella guys. Ken Marino, he's an actor you guys would recognize if you saw a picture of him, but maybe don't know by name. He was on Party Down.
I know his face. I don't know what his writing credits.
Yeah, I don't know how much of a writer he is, but he's obviously a funny guy. So all those people did rewrites on the script before it got made, and this is still what we got. So I wonder what the movie was like before they got to it. Was it better? Was it worse? Who can say?
Did they see the whole script, or did they just give Smigel a scene and go, like, punch this up? But no one tell him about the statutory rape.
Hard to say. Yeah, with uncredited rewrites, it's all about how forthcoming a person's willing to be to tell you how much actually they did. And I don't think anyone's going to be chomping at the bit to tell anyone about their involvement in this movie.
No.
Director Sean Anders had only directed 2 movies before this. First was Never Been Thawed, which no one's seen, including me. And Sex Drive. Never Been Thawed was low budget and got good reviews. Sex Drive, it's a movie that's like out there. I think it's on Netflix. It doesn't have great reviews, but it doesn't have terrible reviews either. It's middle of the pack, financial flop. But then he would go on to direct Horrible Bosses 2, which fucking sucks if you guys ever saw it, but it made a little bit of money. Daddy's Home, the Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell movie, which fucking sucks, but a lot of people saw it. And then Daddy's Home 2, which was even worse, but still made a little bit of money. And then he finally like transitioned out of comedy into like the more family drama, dramedy with that movie Instant Family, which came out in like 2019 with Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne. And that did okay and got good reviews. So maybe he should just stick to that type of wholesome family comedy. Because
quite a trajectory.
I mean, yeah, stick to anything except Adam Sandler.
His raunchy comedies, like Horrible Bosses 2, Daddy's Home, Daddy's Home 2. I hate all those movies, personally. So he's not in my list of favorite directors, to say the least. So Susan Sarandon obviously plays the older Mrs. McGarrigle. Her daughter, Eva Marie Martino, played the younger version of Mrs. McGarrigle. So there's maybe why she was cast as the older actress. I don't know. Who was cast first? I can't say.
Sandler, in one swipe, destroyed two generations of the family.
It's family. And so Susan Sarandon had actually played a teacher who slept with an underage student the year before on 30 Rock. So maybe this was like her little cottage industry of playing sexual predators. I don't know. But she played a teacher who slept with Frank from 30 Rock. If you guys are 30 Rock fans at all.
Oh, yeah.
There was an episode. I think it was Queen of Jordan was the episode where they dealt with her whole storyline. So yeah, this was eerily similar. Only a year later, this movie came out. So I don't remember her agent.
I have to think that 30 Rock handled it better than this movie did.
They did. I wouldn't say they handled it perfectly. 30 Rock is great, but it's not infallible with this type of stuff either.
I'm going to blame Pretty Little Liars on the whole student teacher. I don't know if you guys ever watched Pretty Little Liars, but one of the main romances is a high school student and her teacher. And it was so romanticized, never seen as problematic, more of a secret love. And that was like 2007 and teen girls ate that up. So I'm gonna say that Adam Sandler saw that and it's like, well, I want to reverse the roles and make it fun for dudes.
Oh boy. I'm sorry. There's usually not this many long pauses and deep sighs, but I just don't know like where to pick up with this movie. So
you just want to drop it. That's why.
To get back on the screenplay, maybe being different upon first draft, there's something called the blacklist, the Hollywood blacklist, which is just a list of the best scripts floating around that haven't actually been made yet. And this script appeared on it in 2009. It's not always an indicator of the eventual quality of the movie, but it's usually a good omen when a movie's on that list. And so it makes you wonder, what did he hand in? Was it changed a lot by Sandler? Yeah, exactly. Impressive. This is somehow not Sandler's lowest scoring movie on Rotten Tomatoes, though. He's got a bunch that have done worse. And I want to preface this by saying Rotten Tomatoes is not a perfect like system to gauge this type of thing because they view a 2-star review that's like, this movie's fine, but it's just not for me, the same as they view a 0-star, this is the worst fucking movie I've ever seen. It weighs those two reviews exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So it's not always indicative of the actual Venom.
Except when it's talking about Paddington 2. That's 100% the only exception.
Solid hundo. So the lower rated movies he has are The Cobbler, which I've never seen. Blended, which I think was a reunion with Drew Barrymore, which I've never seen. Mm-hmm. Haley, chime in if you've seen any of these and want to talk about them at all.
Yeah, will do.
The Ridiculous 6 has a 0%. I have seen that for some reason. That movie sucks. Just Go With It, I think, was the Jennifer Aniston one he did, right?
That was
19%. Oh, it was a good one.
Well, okay, it wasn't for Sandler. It was pretty good. Slightly less problematic. It wasn't like the problematic arc. It was just the side jokes were bad. But at the time, people enjoyed it. And I think in light of other Sandler movies, it wasn't as bad.
That rings true to me. That's how I kind of remember it being received when it came out, was mild indifference. Nobody was mad at it.
Yeah.
And then Jack and Jill got 3%. Obviously, Jack and Jill is an abomination, but worth watching just for the Al Pacino, Dunkachino commercial.
Oh, I might have to watch it just for that.
Yeah.
It didn't bomb. It made a little bit of money, so you can't really cover it on the podcast unless you stretch the rules. Grown Ups has 11%. I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry has 15%. God, that's another movie that is just completely fucked as far as its approach to social issues goes.
At least you noticed it. I don't know anything about that movie, but I know to stay away from it. I know that I should not turn that on.
Right.
I didn't know when I just saw Sandler and Sandberg hugging on the DVD box that I should run away.
You just replace it with Kevin James and you know you're fucked.
Then I would be like, okay, I'm staying away.
That movie was a big hit, though. I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry.
Yeah, like,
that was a smash hit for Sandler.
So funny. Two dudes that are married.
Can you imagine? Yeah. That wasn't even that long ago.
No.
8 Crazy Nights. I thought people liked 8 Crazy Nights, but it has a 12% on Rotten Tomatoes. And also it was a bomb. So we might be able to talk about that one day. I don't think that movie's as objectionable as this one. I think it just kind of isn't great. And then Bulletproof, which is going way back. I think that's the movie he made with Damon Wayans many years ago in the mid-90s when he was first trying to break out from SNL. So I've seen that movie at some point, but I don't remember it. And this list must be incomplete because I've got to imagine Grown Ups 2 is also super low on Rotten Tomatoes. Let me just take 8% for Grown Ups 2. So that was left off the list. But he's also given a bunch of jobs to Taylor Lautner, which is like he was in The Ridiculous 6 and Grown Ups 2. It was like, I think that's the only work Taylor Lautner has gotten since that action movie he tried to do after Twilight is just in Sandler movies. So good for him. He gives a lot of people work.
Got some coin to pass out.
We like to talk about where people's careers went after this. Sandler is bulletproof with this type of shit. He went on to make a lot of more movies, some of which are very good, like The Meyerowitz Stories and Uncut Gems, some of which are very bad, like all the rest of
them.
And Sandberg would get the lead role in Brooklyn Nine-Nine the following year in 2013. And then he made movies like Pop Star and Palm Springs, which critics loved, audiences loved when they actually saw them. So he seems to be kind of in his wheelhouse again. Leighton Meester, she made a bunch of small movies after this that didn't really take off, but then she got starring roles in Making History, which was an underrated show that got canceled after one season, and Single Parents, which my wife Jamie watched when it was on. I think it was 3 seasons, but that just recently got canceled. So hoping Leighton Meester finds some good roles because she seems good. I like her as an actress.
She seemed good until I found out what she was doing.
With Milo.
She has good. Yeah. I didn't know her from other stuff, but I actually thought she had, until I couldn't stand watching anything about this movie, I found her watchable on screen and I thought she had some presence.
Yeah, she's definitely got screen presence and she's really good as like a hateable character like Haley alluded to with her Gossip Girls work. And then Milo, good old Milo V. He has been on This Is Us since the beginning as the dad who's, oh, I'm not going to spoil it. This Is Us. I'm sorry. I almost did it again. Oh, yeah. I know people expect spoilers for this movie, but maybe not every movie and show ever made. So I got to be a little more careful. Yeah. So he's on This Is Us as the dad and nothing happens to him as far as I know.
He doesn't commit incest. So
yes, he definitely doesn't do that. Yes,
can hope for that.
So sometimes when we're talking about movies that failed at the box office, we try to figure out why. And I don't think it's very complicated, this one. This movie's fucking horrible. But do you think it would have done better if it had a different title?
It's a good question. I mean, you can always try. I thought that if they would have thought about it a little more, instead of That's My Boy, they should call this movie That's My Bad, because that's the barest minimum apology that everyone involved in this movie should have made to the public. And there's still time.
I like that. Yeah, That's My Bad.
The movie formerly known as That's My Boy.
If they ever make a documentary about the making of this movie, that's what it should be called. At least.
That's My Bad.
Haley, did you have a suggestion?
Yeah, I thought of two. The first one, just a stupid pun, Father Crime, because this movie is a fucking crime.
Nice.
Not a father.
Oh, I like that.
And then I don't know why. I just think it'd be really fucking funny if they called it Grown Ups 3 for no reason. It came out before
Grown Ups 2. Yeah, but I support
honestly,
that.
Honestly, audience would love it. Oh, you know what? I didn't know there was a Grown Ups 2, but I got to see the third one now.
That's kind of like that's an Action Bronson move. He made Blue Chips 1 and 2 and then Blue Chips 7000. So just throw people off. I have Kill Me Madison, like Billy Madison, except I want someone to kill me because I had to watch this movie. And then what else do you have, Ian?
After thinking long and hard, the number one best thing they should have called this movie is Unreleased Adam Sandler Film.
Yes, Unreleased Adam Sandler Film number one.
That's beautiful.
Mine is along, my last one is along the same lines. I just have unfunny people because nobody makes a joke worth making in this movie. And no, I hate it so much. Does anybody have any closing thoughts about the movie they wanted to share?
I'm glad we get to close our thoughts on this movie.
Yes.
I don't think I have the energy to think about it beyond this.
Haley, I promise we will get you back on to talk about like a fun movie at some point in the future.
I had no idea it was going to be like this. it's still fun to talk about. But yeah, there with the weight of all the themes in this movie, it's a little different of the discourse.
Yeah, it's not the rollicking good time we usually have, but we still really appreciate you joining us. And like I said, we will definitely have you back on for a different movie.
It was harrowing, but like we've now bonded over this short trauma that we went through, which is nice.
It is trauma. Oh. I think even the DSM would classify it as that.
My final thought is just whatever funny stuff you might have heard us say during the course of this episode, do not see this movie. Just don't do it for every reason, for yourself, for the movie industry, for just increasing the amount of goodness and light in the universe. Do not see this movie.
Yeah, this movie sucks a lot and it has retroactively made me dislike everyone involved with it just a little bit more. In some cases, a lot more. I don't know what to do with that because some of my favorite people are in this movie, but I really hated watching this and that's about as articulate as I can be about it right now.
Yeah, it's tough. Our journey on this podcast has been to find great joy in the works of Will Forte, in the works of Andy Samberg, and then even in A Flawed Funny People with Sandler, where we found some very redeeming things we liked about him. And then in the third act of our story arc is not coming to an end, but we have come to a dark night of the soul where like everything that we thought we loved has come crashing down around our heads. And it looks very dark right now. And we're going to pivot and try to do a much lighter movie next week and maybe dig out of this funk.
Yeah.
The dawn is darkest before the day.
That's right.
Exactly. So
this movie has just robbed me of my wit and my words. I can't find words anymore. I don't know.
It's dark.
This movie is so bad, but I wish something could have come out of it. You know, it could have made us so disillusioned with Hollywood. It could have brought some powerful people down, but instead it just exists. It's available for people to watch, and that's all it is now. And it didn't have any effect besides just being horrible.
No, it's like an abandoned well in the backyard, mm-hmm. and it's just waiting for some poor child to fall into it.
It's like the Ark of the Covenant to me. Like, you're going to see it and pick it up. You're like, what's this? And your fucking face is going to melt off.
Honestly, that would have been better than watching this movie.
Watching this movie was, your face didn't melt off. It was like stubbing your toe for 2 hours, like repeatedly. Like
my heart just melted off.
Yeah. Anyway, fuck this movie. Thank you guys for listening. But thanks for joining us. Thank you to Haley for coming on.
Thanks, Haley.
Thanks for having me.
Haley, you were awesome. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe to the pod. Do what you got to do to keep us in your life and on your podcast feed. We'll be back next week with a happier movie to talk about. And thanks for joining us. Always, we'll see you next time on The Blast Zone.
See you next time on The Blast Zone.
The Blast Zone.